On this week's 51%, we speak with Keene State College's Lisa DiGiovanni about what she calls militarized masculinity and how it can contribute to the rise of authoritarian leaders.
We actually see it right here in the United States. So it emphasizes dominance over women and other men, the ability to use violence in the name of national security, and it's often linked to anti-liberal, misogynist, and homophobic national identities.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. For years, political scientists, scholars, and lawmakers have been warning about the rise of authoritarian governments worldwide. I mean, earlier this year, a survey of more than 500 political scientists in the U.S. called Brightline Watch found a majority worry our country is shifting toward authoritarianism, whatever kind that might be. Now, there's obviously a lot at play when an authoritarian leader comes to power. I'm not about to tell you that it's all just patriarchy, but our guest today argues that misogyny often plays a bigger role than we tend to recognize, and their regimes often work to uphold or reinstate patriarchal structures. Dr. Lisa DiGiovanni is a professor of modern languages and cultures and Holocaust and genocide studies at Keene State College in New Hampshire. Lately, she's been studying the dictatorial regimes of Francisco Franco of Spain in the late 1930s and Augusto Pinochet in Chile in the 1970s. Both were politically repressive and violent regimes, and both, she says, came after periods of attempted social reform for women, minorities, and the broader working class. DiGiovanni says these regimes also promoted a particular brand of masculinity, what she calls militarized masculinity, that idolizes the soldier and sees military force as the solution to most problems. Her new book, Militarized Masculinity in Spain and Chile, outlines how this brand of masculinity catapulted these two dictators to power and characterized their leadership. She also examines how the arts can be used to expose and resist militarized masculinity and lays out the warning signs that other countries, including the U.S., should look out for.
Militarized masculinity is a constructed gender identity. It's learned, and it's deeply rooted in nationalism. Some of the key characteristics include physical strength and a willingness to use violence to resolve social or political problems. So, militarized masculinity is a gender identity. Militarism is a belief system, and militarization is a process. So all of these things can exist in a society that is totally democratic. Not only military regimes support or cultivate this kind of masculinity, we actually see it here, right here in the United States. So it emphasizes dominance over women and other men, the ability to voluntarily use violence in the name of national security. And it's often linked to anti-liberal, misogynist, and homophobic national identities.
So how does militarized masculinity, I guess, form, and how does it contribute to authoritarian regimes?
So from a young age, boys are exposed to messages about militarism that align with this militarized ideal. I mean, think about toys in the United States, but also, I mean, in the cases that I've studied, Chile and Spain, lots of messages that equate the ideal masculine identity with the soldier, right? You have this message being conveyed obviously in the military institution itself, but also through other forms of education, religion, government, media. And it's about the belief that military force must be used to suppress dissent. The belief that military force is the only means of protecting national interests rather than dialogue, debate. It's the belief that military force must be used to spread national values. It's the belief that a peaceful civilian has feminine traits. It's the belief that the warrior is the quintessential male, and that weakness is associated with femininity and dominance is associated with masculinity. So militarism feeds the notion that struggle is a part of life, that fighting is a value, that war is the most fulfilling human experience. Militarism questions the effectiveness of political debate. It's kind of a politics of anti-politics. Militarism is a belief system that unites genocidal architects, those who plan genocide, rank and file perpetrators, and civilian bystanders. It's very much a mentality that focuses on the strong man leader who can come in and clean up national, social, political problems. And so it's linked to fascism as well.
As you said, your research specifically focuses on two authoritarian regimes in Spain and Chile, that of Francisco Franco in Spain starting in the late 1930s and that of Augusto Pinochet starting in Chile in the 1970s. For those who aren't brushed up on their world history, I guess what happened to bring about these regimes and how do you see militarized masculinity playing a part in them?
Yes, absolutely. So in Spain, the military played a very significant role in shaping Spanish society and reinforcing traditional gender roles. So with the establishment of the Second Republic in 1931, there were many social reforms that were taking root in this period of the Second Republic. So from 1931 to 1936, those who maintained so much power, including the landed elite, the military elite, the Catholic Church, they saw their power threatened. So for them, it was an atheist revolution against traditional values. But for those who supported the Republic, which were included what we can consider middle of the road Democrats, they were called Republicans because they supported the Republic. But they were more like middle of the road Democrats all the way to socialists and communists supported the Republic because of these major reforms that it represented. This was a time of major social change in Spain. And for that reason, writers like Ernest Hemingway were very interested in what was going on in Spain, Langston Hughes in the United States, and then around the world, Picasso, Garcia Lorca, Salvador Dali, the painter. This was a time of massive change. But the backlash, the resistance to that change came to a head in 1936. That's when Francisco Franco led a military coup against the Second Republic. Because the Second Republic did have loyalists in the military, there was a civil war. And so this war was very, very bloody. It lasted for 3 years. And in those 3 years, the Franco insurrectionists, the rebels, were supported by Hitler and Mussolini, while the Republic was kind of left alone. There was an agreement between what would later become the Allied forces in World War II. There was a non-intervention agreement signed by the United States and England and France, but they kept their word and did not help the Second Republic, while Mussolini and Hitler actively supported Francoist troops to overthrow and take over completely what was becoming a very progressive social context. So in 1939, there were many other military leaders that were looking to the Franco regime and were very much inspired. And so on the other side of the Atlantic, you have Pinochet, who was a young military man at the time and saw Franco as a hero. Chile had a long tradition of democratic process, but you also had these very strong divisions between the right and the left, those who wanted to reform these deeply rooted inequalities between men and women and d between different classes and races, those who wanted to reform those, and those who wanted to maintain those hierarchies because they saw them as natural and God ordained and so on. Increasingly in Chile, so if we turn to the Chilean case, in the 1960s, there was an increased movement to broaden access to education and healthcare and to really diminish this massive gap between the rich and the poor. They elected Salvador Allende, and in those 3 years, 1970 to 1973, there were great attempts to implement social change, but those attempts were stymied by the attempts by the right to stop these reforms at every turn. And the United States was very much involved in those efforts to block these massive social reforms because the United States had a lot of industry, a lot of business interests in Chile. Chile is a very large copper producer. Part of the Allende government focused on nationalizing the copper industry so that copper miners, the workers, would actually benefit more from the work. Business elites in Chile who were working alongside business elites in the United States, they were massively profiting from terrible working conditions and very low wages. So in Chile in 1973, there was a military coup. And unlike the case of Spain, there wasn't a civil war. General Pinochet was very sneaky. He managed to eliminate a lot of the opposition in the military so that the coup would be smoother. In those years before 1973, one of the major figures in the military that was going to defend democratic rule and maintain the apolitical nature of the military, General Schneider, he was murdered. So Pinochet took out covertly these different individuals that were going to defend democracy. And so I think that these cases can tell us so much about what's happening in the United States because you see a concentration right now of power in the executive and this interest in using the military to defend that power. So I think that that's one of the reasons why many people are interested in my book because you see all of these parallels.
And how did those regimes play out in Spain and Chile?
So in the case of Spain and Chile, there were these long-term military dictatorships that abolished democracy, abolished voting, implemented restrictive media outlets, restricted educational curriculum. And this was all to maintain power. And those who resisted were imprisoned and tortured and disappeared. There were over 30,000 in the case of Chile of political resistors that were tortured, and 3,000 were murdered, disappeared. In the case of Spain, the numbers are massive because we're talking about a military dictatorship that lasted from 1939 to the death of Franco in 1975. In the case of Chile, it was 1973 to 1989.
And what did this mean for women in these countries? You start out the book by talking about the connection between militarized masculinity and gender-based violence. And you also note that, there are a lot of women who supported these regimes too. Tell me more about that dynamic there.
Absolutely. So, first of all, we need to think about women as not a monolithic group. So, in both the case of Chile and Spain, you had women that both welcomed these military regimes and very much resisted these military regimes. So, militarized masculinity and traditional femininity go hand in hand. Those women who supported the Second Republic in Spain and supported the Allende government in Chile, very much wanted more gender equality. They wanted increased access to professions and just a wider perspective of what being a woman is. But then you had right-wing women in both cases that felt threatened by these changes and wanted to maintain a vision of womanhood as motherhood, as being supportive wives in the home, and so on. So you had this wide range, really a spectrum of female identities, just like you have a whole range of masculinities. Women who were against the regimes, they were framed as anti-woman, anti-man. They were framed as prostitutes. They were framed as, in many ways, this kind of root of moral decay. Feminism was completely vilified. And so those women who were politically active faced multiple forms of repression. Women who were against the regimes were detained. They were tortured for multiple reasons. And this torture was always sexualized. So it involved electrocution to genitals and sexualized body parts, such as the breasts. Rape was involved. And these torture techniques were used to produce a confession, to gain information, but it was also really to punish and to instill fear so that these women would go back into their communities terrified, not wanting to go against the regime, and not wanting to challenge these very patriarchal dictatorships. The torture was brutal in both cases. The men who supported these more progressive reforms in Chile and Spain, they were up against resistance in terms of class and race often. So they were fighting for more economic and racial equality. But women had multiple battles to fight because of their gender.
We're speaking with Lisa DiGiovanni, author of Militarized Masculinity in Spain and Chile. In the book, you also examine how the arts, film, literature, and culture were used to resist or expose the militarized masculinity at play under the regimes of Francisco Franco in Spain and Augusto Pinochet in Chile. Tell me more about that.
Yes. Well, I think that literature and film can denaturalize or, on the other hand, support views of masculinity. So in the case of both Spain and Chile, during the regimes, culture was very much used to support the image of the ideal man as a patriot, as obviously heterosexual, dominant. These images in the cultural sphere reinforce those views that are essential for upholding these dictatorships. On the other hand, you have writers and filmmakers that portray all of the downfalls, all of the problems with that view of masculinity and femininity, and specifically in the cases of Spain and Chile, works that can specifically bring out the human rights violations perpetrated by these authoritarian regimes. During both regimes, there was a lot of censorship. So many writers had to write through allegory. But then after these regimes were over, there was a what we could call a memory boom in both places. So there was an outpouring of testimonies and documentaries and novels and films, short stories, poetry that brought out the perspectives of the victims of these and survivors of these military regimes. I think that beyond showing, there are many cultural works, films, and novels that can denaturalize the view of men as being naturally dominant and women as being naturally submissive. Literature has this potential to explore these different stories, personal stories through narratives, through narrative voices, narrators that bring complexity to these views of men and women and these strict gender identities and these ideas that militarism, nationalism, and masculinity are all linked, and bravery is absolutely linked to physical dominance. What they do is, in denaturalizing them, they often also will show other forms of masculinity and other forms of femininity, forms of masculinity that are more rooted in emotional sensitivity instead of emotional stoicism, that are not homophobic, that aren't misogynist. Narrators can bring out all of these complexities and make readers think differently. It's about the thinking. It's about the thinking. These identities are not fixed identities. They're learned. And if they're learned, they can be unlearned.
As you say, militarized masculinity is in democratic countries too. And a lot of what you're saying, I mean, it just reminds me of things that we're seeing here in the US with debates around where masculinity is headed. Calls for more traditional gender roles, efforts by the federal government to ramp up deportations or even deploy the National Guard to cities. I guess, what do you think other countries can learn from your book from what happened in Spain and Chile?
Well, we need to look at all of these warning signs. We really do. So the United States is not a militarized society like North Korea is. However, militarism as a belief system is very deeply rooted, meaning that we see this image of the warrior as the quintessential male. We see it right now, definitely through the figure of Pete Hegseth, who is actively going against a lot of the progressive reforms that the military has made in the United States. He talks about the warrior ethos. He talks about invading. Right now, the situation in Venezuela has become extremely inflamed. It's this mentality that any problem, any social political problem, can be resolved through military force. And I think that we in the United States, we need to see that that mentality is a dead end. We need to return to the idea that democratic debate, not the use of force, is the most long-lasting, effective solution to political difference, to social difference. A huge moment for me was watching the insurrection, the attacks on the Capitol. My big question was, what is the military institution going to do? Because many of the military insurrectionists actually were former military, they had military skills. And if the military had sided with the insurrectionists, I don't think that it is an exaggeration to say that we would be living in a different time right now. It's very possible that this would look more like a dictatorship if the military had completely supported the insurrectionists on that day. So we need to look at these different patterns because some of the rhetoric on that day and the days that followed, the idea that politics doesn't work, that politicians are all corrupt, that we need a strong leader that will, quote unquote, clean up problems. This is euphemistic language that we actually saw in these different military regimes.
I mean, I think a lot of people might see the warning signs, but feel pretty powerless about what to do next. I mean, it's a pretty big question. It's not necessarily one that I expect you to have the answer to, but what can people do to resist militarized masculinity beyond recognizing it?
First of all, we need to take very seriously processes towards militarization. We can for instance, use our voices to influence our own political representatives to say no to the militarization of cities, for instance. On a very personal level, and this is over time, I think that we need to question our own ingrained beliefs in the military as the solution to political conflict. I think that that is absolutely key. It's so key. We need to believe in democracy. We need to believe in the political process. I think right now we are at a point in the United States where half of the country believes that the use of force is the best solution, the most effective response to political conflict, political problems. Political conflict does not have to explode into violence. It does not have to. And so, if we believe that it does not have to, we can be part of the change to stop it from happening. But what we're seeing unfold right now in the United States is extremely dangerous, this view that violence is the solution. So I think that on a daily basis, we can question our own assumptions. We can think about the media that we consume. Think, for instance, of Call of Duty, all of these video games and films that absolutely reinforce many of these views. There's a glorification of violence that is everywhere in society. We need to actively question that, use our voices, intervene, go against jokes that demean non-militarized men and feminist women. There are all of these microaggressions that take place on a daily basis that are actually in the United States just absolutely, they're simmering and starting to boil over. Those microaggressions can be resisted by micro and macro forms of resistance. So I think that we need to start with ourselves. Then there's also kind of the larger question of how much should we invest in the military? And there are so many problems in the world right now. And so I'm not right now stating that we should abolish the military, but we need to think more about the military in terms of defense rather than a war-producing institution. It's a huge warning sign right now that Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump are calling the Department of Defense the Department of War. We need to use our voices to reject that notion, that actually soldiers can be peacekeepers, not war makers. I think that we need to think about the messages that we're teaching our children. Are we buying them guns or are we buying them books? I don't want to be simplistic here, but we have a culture that is deeply seeped in gun culture, and that gun culture is related to militarism. I think that we need to connect the dots. We need to see these parallels. We need to see connections and act on them.
Dr. Lisa DiGiovanni is professor of modern languages and cultures and Holocaust and genocide studies at Keene State College in New Hampshire. Her book is Militarized Masculinity in Spain and Chile, Remembering Violence Through Film and Literature. It's out now through the University of Toronto Press. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along.